want to thank Kelsey again for all of her hard work. She did probably the bulk of this. I think Joel and I would agree on that. So I'd like to thank her again for her hard work. I also want to thank all of you for sticking around at 5 o'clock when you're tired. Maybe you can stay awake, hopefully. It's short and sweet and to the point, kind of like my personality sometimes, so maybe not the sweet part. But anyway, so I am going to talk about putting this all into perspective. And I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but I think we are here because the significance of exposure characterization is often forgotten in risk assessments. Risk, again, is the likelihood of harm under relevant conditions. So you have to have the co-occurrence of hazard and exposure. And this looks very similar to Sam's figure that we had earlier today, but the overlapping ovals there. But you have to have both hazard and exposure to actually have potential for risk or harm to organisms, non-target organisms specifically. And what we've seen in the literature recently, I believe, is more of a focus, even globally, on hazard or effects characterization and not maybe taking into context the actual exposure that is occurring. And I cite one paper, but there are numerous papers that are evidence of this, where maybe a hazard is shown, but the actual characterization of the dose or the exposure that occurred to those organisms was lacking. And so my hope is that what will come out of this symposium is that we will kind of pat ourselves on the back and say, yes, we're doing a good job and we should continue to do this work. But we do need to take a step back and go from a risk assessment standpoint and look at problem formulation. And this is just sort of a mock estimate if we went through transgenic protein X or Z in this case. And we'd sort of made some crude estimations of how much protein could potentially be in the environment. And again, this is a problem formulation kind of, let's say a what-if scenario here. We could potentially have maybe 11.5 million kilograms of protein Z produced annually in the U.S. alone. That's not taking into context, other countries, et cetera. So if we do have persistence of some type of protein in the environment, for example, a Tappan-Stotsky paper that detected protein in soil greater than 8 months using an insect bioassay, if we do have persistence of this, there would be potential for cause for concern if there were large quantities of protein being released into the environment, if the proteins persist for a long period of time, and if the proteins are in an active state, that they are not degraded and therefore not active. So what we need to do then is to address these questions: if large quantities are released, if the proteins persist, and if they are in an active state. So the questions become then, how long do proteins persist in the environment, and do proteins degrade? Essentially what we're doing is looking at the environmental fate profile of proteins, which is very comparable to what our colleagues in the chemical pesticide industry have done for years. They've had 50 or more years to develop those methods, and we've been doing it in, 10 or something? So to look at environmental fate of proteins, we might want to start on the macro scale and look at the cropping system. And I have a really interesting diagram here, but it's just a corn plant. So where might the corn plant go? And so we could have pollen shed that could end up on the soil surface, on plants in the field margins or within the field. You could have pollen shed then reaching water bodies of some sort, crop residue runoff, root exudation, all of the things that we've talked about today. But we also need to consider possible fate in soil on a micro scale. And we've touched on these things all day today, but adsorption to soil organic matter, adsorption to clays, the mechanisms could include cation exchange or bridging, possible hydrophobic interactions, things that could be characterized in laboratory studies like we've discussed earlier. Again, also potential for biodegradation, looking at bacteria or fungi populations, possibility for extracellular proteases. Proteins could potentially be readily broken down into amino acids, and those amino acids could then be transported into cells for further degradation or used for synthesis of new proteins within those microorganisms. So these are just possible fates in a micro scale. It's pretty widely known that, and at least in the agronomy/soil world, organic matter decomposition kind of proceeds in this rank form. For soil microorganisms, bacteria, actinomycetes, fungi, you might think of it in the same way that you go to the refrigerator at home. If you're really hungry, you're going to grab what's easy to eat, not always, maybe the most healthy thing, but what's easy, what's fast. rather than if you're really hungry, waiting and making a big Thanksgiving meal. Same thing for soil microorganisms. They're going to start by degrading the things that are easiest for them: sugars, starches, water-soluble proteins, working their way up to crude protein, hemicellulose, cellulose, and then the more difficult things to degrade being oils, waxes, fats, lignin, etc. So this is just sort of a rank order, but that doesn't tell us exactly how fast proteins degrade. And when I say protein, I'm talking either transgenic or a non-transgenic protein, just a protein in general. So the objective of the data, the study that I'm going to present, was to determine the dissipation rate of several common proteins in soil, just to provide context to compare for dissipation rates of transgenic proteins. So our hypothesis was that a common protein, or any protein really, and a transgenic protein would have similar dissipation rates. Essentially, you're saying a protein is a protein to a soil. It doesn't matter. So the methods included, the common proteins that we chose were Rubisco, wheat germ agglutinin, or WGA, is what I'll refer to it as hereafter, and then bovine serum albumin, or BSA, as we've all heard before. We chose those based on their likelihood to occur in the environment, that being for Rubisco or WGA, for instance, coming from plant systems, and then also ease of analysis for BSA. We spiked to 100 ppm in soil, and that allowed us to do the quantitative Western blotting technique Kelsey discussed earlier today. We used a PBS control to determine if there were any background levels in the soil, and we used a TAMA soil, which is a silt loam, pretty representative of an agronomic soil that you would see in a cropping system. We did verify that it was microbially active before we started the study so that we knew it was as relevant to field situations as could be possible for a laboratory study. The experimental setup was 100 milligrams of soil, and our time points were 0 to 7 days at various time points in between. We had 5 reps per time point per protein. We used the high salt or high pH buffers she referred to earlier today. Again, the analysis was with quantitative Western blotting. So to get into the nitty-gritty here, this is a very typical dissipation curve that you might expect for almost any protein or any compound, really, for that matter. On the y-axis, we've got percent of day zero extractable. On the x-axis, we've got time in days. What we see for BSA is a DT50 of less than 24 hours, with the lower limit of quantitation in soil being 0.4 ppm. So you can see pretty rapid degradation, or dissipation, excuse me. For Rubisco, we see something very similar, textbook dissipation curve, really. DT50 estimations less than 6 hours, the lower limit of quantitation, 1.1 ppm in soil. So it's dissipating very rapidly in this soil. Then we come to WGA. And I don't have a great explanation for this, but it's a very interesting case and points to the analytical challenges that we have with detecting proteins in soil. So what you actually see here, again, is day zero percent extracted on the y-axis and then time across the bottom. What we saw was sort of an initial decrease in what we expected in terms of the concentration of WGA in soil. And then all of a sudden we saw a really rapid increase in concentration. And it was actually ended up above what we spiked the soil to. So taking a step back and looking at this and realizing that lectins are known to be very stable, first of all, they're often used in kind of chemical ecology between plants and microbes in the rhizosphere of plants. So it makes sense that they would be stable in soil. But they also form complexes with carbohydrates. And so my thought is that it's possible we are increasing the immune reactivity of the WGA in the soil matrix, that somehow whatever it's interacting with in the soil matrix is then increasing immune reactivity. And so in our detection method, we're detecting more, essentially, than we actually spiked into the system. So again, points to problems, but also shows that WGA is very stable over time. And again, our quantitation was 5.6 ppm. So what we saw when looking at these common proteins was that DT50 times are ranging from less than 24 hours to greater than 7 days. The mechanisms of dissipation are likely adsorption and microbial degradation, which is not surprising. And we did find that some proteins readily dissipate. The WGA was kind of the exception to that and being more stable. But these results are similar to the cryoproteins. And so what I'm going to show you next is a way to put this in perspective further, comparing proteins to proteins. So do transgenic proteins degrade in a similar manner to common proteins? And the answer appears to be yes, based on these results. What we see for, and I pulled these from the literature here, but for the Cry1 proteins, we're having DT50s in the 10 to possibly up to 40 days using different methods than we did, but that would be comparable to what we saw with WGA, longer DT50 times. With our own proteins, GAD and GMHRA, we saw very short dissipation times, very rapid dissipation, and that's comparable to BSA or Rubisco. So this kind of brings about another interesting question then. If you look at this in terms of a total agroecosystem and what the other alternatives are out there, we can really realize that proteins are dissipating very rapidly in soil compared to the alternative pesticides that might typically be used, say, for a corn rootworm problem or something like that. Now, again, I realize that Aldrin is, you know, kind of a worst case, a bad actor here, but I'm trying to provide context for the technology that's being used compared to what we did in the past. And these data were obtained from publicly available peer-reviewed sources. So again, what we're seeing is, though there may be slight variability in protein dissipation times, it again, compared to other alternative insecticides, they're very rapid dissipation. So to conclude, proteins, whether transgenic or not, tend to degrade rapidly in soils using several mechanisms, adsorption or microbial degradation. And in terms of the GM crop risk assessment paradigm, we can sort of look at this in a different way of looking at substantial equivalence almost. Are transgenic proteins substantially equivalent to another protein that might be occurring in a plant? And I'm really glad I followed Carrie, because she talked about basically DNA is DNA in terms of what happens in the soil, so essentially anyway. Also, exposure assessment, as we all know, is critical to the risk assessment process and cannot be forgotten. This is particularly important in the problem formulation step and needs to be better understood, I think, on a global basis. You can't just have a hazard. There has to be some sort of exposure context that has to be put into. So we need to understand not only having improved methodologies, but also being sure that we pair those data together in our risk assessments and in publications as well. And with that, I think I'm short and sweet and done, and you can ask questions if you'd like, or yawn and stretch, either one.
Are there any questions?
Yes. Well, you could look at that two ways, I guess. If the proteins aren't persisting very long, then the likelihood of actual exposure occurring is pretty slim. So then do you need to worry about hazard? Now, I'm just sort of posing questions here, but if the actual cause of the concern, being the insecticidal protein, is not present, then is it worth even doing the hazard assessment? Would be one way to look at that. But I do agree that there's need for harmonization in terms of types of hazard studies that occur, and this is more on a global basis. I think the U.S. Regulatory bodies have a kind of a good handle on this type of thing, but we don't see the same consistency across other countries. And I'd open this up to people who have been doing this longer than 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I do like the idea of a symposium, because I think it does brings all of us together that come from different backgrounds, diverse backgrounds, and different ways of looking at the problem to kind of come to a realization that there are many viewpoints and there are many options for us to, you know, improve the process that we have currently. Yes?
I still think it raises a bigger question. We had discussed here is post-release of this proxy litigation. Pre-release, it was 3 or 4 or 5 years of studies. And it seems like things are striking out of both things. Neither long exposure nor high hazard. So, as far as I can tell, the problem has generally been pretty minimal. And I'm sort of wondering what point to say we've done enough. You know that the systems that are out there now, there's so much data sets, you could probably use an extrapolation one place to make. How much more do you have to look at?
Well, I think thus far, I mean, we've focused mostly on the cry proteins, and the technology is moving in other directions other than BT focus. So you could have altered pathways somehow that could potentially affect things. So I think, yeah. Okay. I think it depends on your definition of smoking gun.
What's the worst thing that anybody's heard that you think is the same?
I mean, what happens is, I think, in the literature, you see published papers that are doing hazard assessments, and they, but maybe are increasing dose well above what might be in the environment. And so I'm not necessarily saying that it's right by any means, but that happens. And then what happens again in the regulatory arena is that the response is expected. So whether or not it's science-based, maybe neither here nor there, I guess.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you.